Hey guys, today on the show, I have Dr. Karen Nee, an occupational therapist from Southern California who specializes in animal-assisted therapy. Karen has an extensive background in working with and training dogs for use within therapeutic intervention. She runs her own private practice called Sundog Therapy and has two amazingly cute dogs named Tater and Dottie that she uses within her therapy sessions. During this episode, Karen shares with us so much information about the world of animal-assisted therapy, and I have to tell you, I learned a lot from this conversation. So sit tight for 1 second while I go fetch this episode.
If you're interested in occupational therapy, this is the place for you. This show aims to explore our profession by sharing who we are and what we do. Because for us, occupational therapy is more than just a job. Hi, I'm Sarah. Welcome to OT for Life.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. You staying dry over there?
Yeah. But we, like you said, we haven't been able to do like our normal activities.
Yeah. Yeah. I recently started like taking walks at night, like after work and after dinner, just like going for a short walk. And I like started to just love it. And this week I'm like, it's not happening.
Yeah. Dottie's usually needs to play fetch a couple times a day, but like one really long one where we go to the park and she just can run and run.
Yep.
So that hasn't happened. So she's trying to give me the ball right now.
Oh, no.
You know, extra squeaky or ball dropping noises.
I'm so excited to have you come on. As I was like preparing for the episode, I was just like, oh my gosh, I have so many questions. And I was totally scrolling and like stalking you on Instagram the other day. Oh. I literally looked at all of your pictures. This is going to be awesome. So I would love to start. I have a fun little question for you.
Okay.
What is your favorite occupation?
That's a good one. As of right now, it really is just spending time with my dogs.
I had a feeling it was going to be that one.
Yeah. But usually, like going outside is where we feel the most, I guess, in tune with everything. I like to just kind of watch the dogs explore and sniff around. And then, you know, it's just nice being out, kind of invigorating all your senses in a way.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm looking at your picture on the little Skype thing, and it's like you and the two dogs, like totally out hiking or somewhere. You're outside.
Tater's first hike with us. He was only maybe 6 months old at the time, so we just did like a flat hike, nothing serious. But it was back in Albuquerque where there's a nice mountain, so we wanted to kind of take him and see how he would do on a hike because Daddy always loved it. So.
And you have two dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, they are absolutely adorable. They're so, both of them, they're so cute.
Yes. But I think one of the reasons they might be, you know, I say they're my favorite occupation is because they do spend a lot of time, you know, working with them and training them and just relaxing with them. So definitely becomes a big part of your lifestyle to have either just have dogs in general, but especially when you're working with them.
There's really no separation. Like you're always with them and probably working and training and doing like trying out things and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
And so I want to jump in because I think the practice area that you are in within occupational therapy is so fascinating. And I know a tiny bit about it, but not really all that much. And most of what I know is from kind of the hippotherapy lens and not the canine or animal assisted, or I should say maybe outside of the horse world. And so I would love for you to just kind of give a little explanation as to what is animal assisted therapy.
Yeah, so I might have to go a little bit broader first. So there's the big category of animal-assisted interventions. And these terms that I'm about to kind of describe, we're trying to get that more utilized by everyone if possible, but they've been agreed upon by different leading organizations like Animal-Assisted Intervention International, the American Veterinary Medical Association. There's the International Association of Human Animal Interaction Organizations, Pet Partners, which is a volunteer therapy animal organization, and probably a couple more that I'm forgetting right now. But these organizations have determined that it's confusing what people say or mean when they say animal-assisted therapy or therapy dogs. They're trying to kind of differentiate between the different categories by, you know, publishing this terminology either on the websites or in papers and that sort of thing. So animal-assisted interventions overall, you know, just kind of discuss the incorporation of animals, you know, into healthcare or human service settings. But then you kind of differentiate then from there, animal-assisted activities are more of the informal, kind of recreational or more for like the social emotional benefits, since they're typically led by a volunteer team or someone who's not licensed or degreed or working specifically on a therapeutic intervention. But there are therapeutic benefits, of course, of someone coming in to visit people at a hospital, for instance. Mm-hmm. But we kind of want to distinguish that there is a difference because maybe during the animal assisted activities, they don't know the whole patient or client's history or what their therapeutic goals are. They're just there to be to share their animals with these people and hope that they find some comfort or relief or enjoyment from the interactions. But they don't necessarily target a specific therapeutic goal, and they're not documenting it or, you know, tracking outcomes typically, that sort of thing. So then animal-assisted therapy, on the other hand, that's when there is a licensed or degreed healthcare or human service professional like an OT, PT, nursing, counselor, therapist, social worker. It could be anything really along those lines. They do, they're intentionally incorporating the animal as part of a treatment plan. So they are tracking, you know, documenting and evaluating outcomes and making sure that the incorporation of the animal is purposeful and goal directed.
That makes complete sense, because I know in hippotherapy, I know there's been this big push of delineating between hippotherapy, which is using the horse for movement done by an occupational therapist, physical therapist, or speech therapist, and then equine assisted activities, which could be done by pretty much anybody. And so there has been kind of this big push to delineate between the two and recognizing that hippotherapy is done by a therapist or somebody mm-hmm. with a degree, as opposed to like a volunteer team. So it sounds like it's pretty similar in that respect.
Yeah, definitely. And then even, I think those are, I only mentioned two categories, but there are actually two more categories for animal-assisted interventions. The third one is very similar. It's animal-assisted education. So instead of therapy or a therapist leading it, it's, you know, a teacher or in the school setting, it's for, you know, the educational goals. So even in maybe an OT who works in the school setting, they kind of have to cross the lines in between therapy, animal-assisted therapy, and animal-assisted education. But
is that like when, because I've seen it like posted on social media where they're bringing dogs into like the library to help with reading and they have like the kids that are all sitting around. Is that kind of what the educational one would be?
It could be, but then you have to think again, like, is there a teacher that's involved that is maybe thinking of specific children in mind or their goals? Or is it more like just volunteers coming in and okay. animal-assisted activities? So there is like, you know, lines that are blurred, but that's kind of what makes it both challenging and interesting, I guess. Yeah. And then the fourth category would be animal support. Typically through Animal Assisted Intervention International, which is kind of our equivalent of AOTA, where they're trying to connect a bunch of professionals from around the world that are involved in this and kind of creating standards of practice and competencies and an accreditation process for all this. So there's a little category for the people who might be involved in training the dogs or evaluating or supporting the animals in any way that are involved in these interventions, which typically might be assistance dog organizations. But if you think about it, if I'm the one handling the dog, I'm also part of animal support. So the reason why this category exists is that we want to make sure the animal's health and well-being are considered and really taken into account into everything that we're doing.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I think that's a really interesting concept that unless you're working with animals, it's probably something that you haven't thought about before. Mm-hmm. And making sure that you are not overworking the animals, that you're giving them adequate breaks. I mean, it's almost like labor laws for people, right? And I think a lot of people just kind of overlook that when you're using an animal, it's like, oh, they're fine. Like they can just keep going. And not necessarily, because if the animal's well-being is being tested, they might snap back. Like they'll start getting burnout almost as like a person would.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And a lot of times some of us even really consider the animals as like co-therapists. I call them my canine co-therapist, because they are helping to direct and facilitate, you know, the interventions or facilitate progress towards goals. And sometimes they have their own ideas that end up working out really well. And in that sense, then we're not necessarily like humanizing them, but giving them a bigger job or purpose. And instead of saying maybe we're using this equipment, I want to say like I'm collaborating or, you know, working together with my dog. So it kind of also, if you want to be picky or specific about language, sometimes people might not even want to say the word using an animal. They want to kind of make it more, I guess, friendly or showing more of the animal's role.
So it's like almost less of like a modality. Probably a lot of people would think like, oh, it's like a modality. It's like a ball. It's like a swing, right? But what you're saying, it's actually more of a co-therapist or somebody who is working alongside with you.
It could be. I think it really depends on the animal's training, the handler's training. So, you know, it could be anything from maybe the animal is just kind of like sitting there like a ball or like some sort of toy. It could be a stuffed animal at that point versus, you know, if the animal has its own ideas and, if they, you know, their therapeutic use of self.
Right. Even.
So it can vary based on each animal, I think.
Is there like a certain certification process, or like how does somebody, if they're interested in being able to use animals within their therapy session, how would they go about that?
So as of now in OT, I don't know of any programs or certificates that exist for specifically our field, and there's none like overarching one, like no large governing body like NBCOT for OT. We don't have to sit for any tests or prove we got a certain amount of education and experience, which I mean that's tricky to be able to establish, so that's kind of why it doesn't exist,
right?
But there definitely needs to be a certain expectation or amount of training and experience that someone should have before really being involved in this and being having it as part of their work. So first, you need continuing education yourself on just, you know, animals in general, depending on what animal you're working with. Like for dogs, for instance, you want to know in general, what is human-animal interactions? How might animals bring benefits to different areas? And if there's, you know, research that supports this, there's continuing to be more and more research in this field, as well as knowing the animal's, you know, behavior. So I got more continuing education in dog behavior, a little bit of dog training. I kind of went above and beyond the dog training aspect since now I'm a certified professional dog trainer. But that's not, you know, not everyone who does animal assisted therapy goes into that field as in detail as I did. But I enjoy dog training as well. So dog behavior, dog training, and then also the handling part. Those are kind of three separate categories. And then really knowing how to connect all that together. So you would have to do ideally some sort of hands-on experience. It's somewhere possibly that, you know, already has programs in existence, being able to work with professionals and learn from them, which is what I ended up doing. But I got to do my level 2 field work as well as a doctorate residency, and then I worked for about another year after that in a setting that kind of specialized in this, and we had up to 10 or more dogs at a time that I could kind of work with and learn from and also, you know, incorporate into the therapeutic interventions.
I think that's pretty interesting too, especially if it is a student or somebody who is looking to go into OT school that might be listening to this, trying to get experience while you're a student and trying to make at least one of your field works within a setting that at least either does this fully or has a portion of it where they're doing animal assisted therapy. But then even if you are already practicing, you could maybe start volunteering and just getting some hours there, or potentially trying to like reach out and start just to get some experience and start working at a facility that might do something like this.
Yeah. So my mentor is Melissa Winkle. She's the owner of Dogwood Therapy Services and also president of Animal Assisted Intervention International. So I kind of won the jackpot there. And she's been a big part, a big leader in OT and animal assisted therapy, and even got her, was it the fellow of AOTA? I don't know what the official term, but you know, the FAOTA. So she's been recognized for her contributions in this area, which is amazing. And she really recommends that if someone who is kind of brand new to this, and one way obviously is to do an internship or, you know, post-professional rotation, but another way is if you already have a dog and feel like the dog can be at least well trained for obedience and loves to be around other people and might have a good experience with possibly becoming a therapy dog, they can look into volunteer visiting first to kind of get their feet wet and also get more experience, you know, working with their dog, training them, handling them, and being around different populations, maybe similar to ones they work with, but not having the pressure to be directing a therapeutic intervention. They kind of just get to, you know, do like meet and greets and visit people in different settings, and it's a good opportunity for them to really get more experience on the dog side of it, the handling side, and not have to worry so much about the therapeutic side yet.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's quite a bit of kind of different paths that you could take in order to start to get exposure, or at least
I probably didn't take the most typical path. I'm trying to like make it more realistic for other people.
But yeah, I want to unpack that a little bit more, because I know you said you had the experience as a level 2 field work and then you did your doctorate rotation there too. So where did this whole, well, first, like, I want to be an OT and I want to be an OT that incorporates animals in therapy. Where did that all start?
I went to USC for undergraduate. And at the time, I think freshman year, I was first a psychology major and then I was a neuroscience major. And then I was like trying to figure out, you know, when I was taking some of these beginning classes, I was definitely very interested in something science or possibly medical related, you know, making... The biggest thing I wanted to do was kind of make a difference or a positive impact on other people's lives. So that could be very vague. but, you know, that's the kind of general feeling that I wanted to have. So I didn't want to become a doctor, though. That wasn't kind of my thing. And then I've always loved animals, but I didn't want to become a vet because that's, you know, have to do surgeries and other sorts of processes. And I interned in high school and I realized, oh, this is probably not my thing. So I kind of knew some things that were crossed off. And fortunately, I had a dorm mate or someone on my floor that kind of suggested, hey, have you heard about occupational therapy? I think you might be good at it. She didn't really know too much about it either, but, you know, kind of just planted the seed, I guess, in my mind, like, oh, what is occupational therapy? I literally have never heard about it before she mentioned it, because she, I think, heard about some classes that were offered to undergrads, some electives that people could take, and she heard good things about it. So then I just did a bunch of Googling from there, and really liked the, you know, general philosophy of OT. We really look at what is meaningful to each person and how can we get that person to be able to do those things that really matter to them. And so that really, I guess, spoke to me. At the same time, I was Googling things like, still, like, how can I work with animals? So I always wanted to do both.
And now, did you have the dogs at that time?
No. I had one dog. He's living with my mom right now. He's 14.
Okay.
So I've had a dog since I was probably about in middle school. being in middle school. So, but I, that was my first dog, and my mom's never had a dog. So my first dog is very different than the two I have now. Like, we were lucky to train him to be able to sit. That was about it. And he just is not a big fan of other people. So that was my beginning experience with animals. But I was looking around, and I, you know, heard about zookeepers and other sorts of jobs that involve animals. And one of them was animal assisted therapy. So I was looking more into that. And it didn't look like at the time that it was necessarily a paid position. It was mostly volunteers that I was reading about. But I was thinking, like, well, why couldn't this be part of, you know, OT or PT or anything? Like, I imagine it would be a good match or a good part. It could be a good part of an intervention. And so that's kind of, you know, more Googling into the dark hole of the internet. You kind of get stuck going to different pages. And I think I just had somehow ended up doing OT and animal assisted therapy. And I believe Melissa showed up and maybe a few other links, but that's the one that kind of, you know, I remember the most, obviously, because I ended up contacting her later to do an internship with her. So I knew it was possible at that point.
That's a crazy story. Like,
yeah.
how fortunate, A, that you were at USC, right? Mm-hmm. And that they had an OT program there, and a very good OT program. And then to have somebody, dorm mate or a friend, like somebody say, hey, you should check this out. Like, there were so many little things that all had to connect in order for that to happen. And I think that's so cool that it just all kind of came together.
Yeah. So immediately after I, you know, made all these revelations, like the next semester, sophomore year, I signed up for the OT elective. I don't remember what it's called at that time, but it was kind of related to lifestyle redesign. So that was really cool, where we got to kind of just look at our own selves as occupational beings and our life balance and all of that. And that kind of cemented the idea, like, yes, I want to pursue this. So then I ended up applying to the accelerated bachelor's to master's program after that. And things kind of all fell into place from there.
So pretty much from the moment that you knew that you wanted to do OT, you also knew that you wanted to use animals in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you just, I mean, you like programmed, you created your entire, or you based your entire kind of schoolwork around that idea. That's awesome. That's so cool.
Yeah. So like you mentioned, if other students are listening to this, I was able to, luckily the professors or faculty at USC are very supportive of our different ideas. So sometimes when there is an opportunity to do like a literature review or critically appraised papers, all this, I was able to do some related to animals. Some of them might not have been OT specific, but I was able to create links to, like, well, this is how an OT would, how it would fall under either a scope of practice or what an OT could do in this situation. And then I did other projects, like we did a qualitative study that kind of just looked at the impact of graduate students having pets, if it was, you know, beneficial, or I mean the drawbacks, that sort of thing. So we just interviewed some of our classmates about that. And then another one was about community-based practice, so creating some sort of program about seniors being able to adopt senior pets. So I kind of had fun there.
Oh, cool.
Really anything related to what you want to do, whether it's animals or anything else, trying to take advantage of the time you have in school to be able to do these sort of digging and researching and kind of exploring more about what are the possibilities out there for OTs to be involved in different areas.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I'm like super jealous that you had this plan, because I like didn't know what OT was. I found out about it. I like jumped into the profession, and my experience was in pediatrics. And so I pretty much assumed that I was going to do pediatrics like once I graduated, but that was about it. Like, and that, I mean, pediatrics is still pretty broad.
Yeah.
And so like, I could only imagine if I had like this concise plan of where I wanted to go, how that could have changed my kind of process going through school and almost tailoring everything that you can within respect to what it is that you are interested in. And so, yeah, I'm very jealous that you were able to accomplish that.
Yeah. It definitely helps. At least, you know, you have an idea for what you want to do for different projects, but it doesn't hurt either if you don't know, because then you can explore like everything or anything.
True. The grass is always greener, right?
Yeah.
And so I want to jump in, and I'd love to know, and I'm sure this is going to be kind of a hard question to compartmentalize, but I kind of want to know what a typical session would look like as you're using the animals, or maybe some ideas of ways that you incorporate using the dogs within your therapy.
Yeah, so I mean, each session is different, but I can more speak about maybe different ways they can be incorporated. So one way, obviously, is, you know, having the animal present in the therapeutic environment kind of changes things a bit for a lot of individuals. You know, imagine someone coming into therapy, either sometimes they don't want to be there, or sometimes they're, you know, kind of nervous or hesitant to speak or participate. So even just having the dog present kind of becomes more welcoming and friendly, and you know, might decrease some of their stress or anxiety. They have something else to focus on, possibly, besides having to, you know, make direct eye contact with either a stranger or someone they don't know too well. So helping to build that rapport both with, you know, the client, and then they're also bonding with the animal. So bonding with the animal and the therapist at the same time helps just to be able to kind of initiate and start therapy or make more progress during therapy. So we could just have the animals, they're either sleeping or they're going to say hi, or they're going to bring up a toy to play with. Really, we just let the dogs kind of decide what they want to do at that point when they're greeting people who come in, because we like that, you know, their spontaneous interactions. So that's really nice, because you also figure out sometimes the dogs even have their favorite people. They have favorites. They like some clients more than others for whatever reason, and vice versa. Some clients prefer one dog over another dog. And that was really evident when I worked at Dogwood, because there's more dogs there. Like I mentioned, there's between 5 to 10 or more dogs at a time. So you can tell who's more excited than someone else. And that really helps to also kind of get things started. It's like, oh, like the dogs are happy to see me. Like now I'm, you know, happy to be here because I'm happy to see the dogs too. So I can kind of get things started off on a good note. And then even just having dogs present nearby if we're maybe not doing something directly with the dogs, because not every goal can be involving animals as therapy, depending on what the goal is, then it's just nice having them there. But we do like to really incorporate them as much as possible, especially if that's what someone is interested in or motivated by. So the dogs can be there as that motivational tool or kind of focus of an activity. So maybe for example, if we're working with children, we have nice obstacle courses that we can build to work on different gross motor skills and coordination and all that. So maybe someone has to build an obstacle course for the dog, and they have to show them how they will navigate through it. So thinking of all the planning and sequencing and motor skills that have to be involved in that, just to set up all those things and also be able to figure out what's the first, second, third, et cetera, what direction they're going in. That can be really cool, because they're just not thinking of, I don't know, maybe if it's difficult, they're not thinking about how hard it is, but like, oh, this is going to be so fun for the dog and I to do together.
It almost gives them like a separate motivation. It's not, oh, I'm doing it for me, so I'm going to make it easy. It's like, no, I'm making it for the dog and I think this will be fun for the dog. And they kind of like separate themselves from it, but then ultimately they're doing it as well.
Yeah. So sometimes that can be really helpful for someone who might be a little bit more hesitant, or if they're afraid to try something. Like sometimes they've never been on like a balance cushion or equipment. My dog Dottie loves to stand on those, so she'll show off and she'll like, hey, it's not so bad. Like, look, it's so easy. I'm balancing on this. So it almost kind of, you know, makes things not easier, but like makes people willing to try new things a little bit. So maybe they see a dog doing it, like, oh, it can't be too bad. The dog's like, looks like it's having so much fun.
Right.
Yeah, so definitely motivational. Sometimes we might have, you know, people bring dog treats in very unique ways. So more like navigating different, either an obstacle course or being able to, you know, hold something without dropping it and while going across the room. that sort of thing. But can also be also like a theme. So sometimes we'll like make toys and treats for the dogs. And, you know, that way we can work on cooking skills, or, you know, maybe we'll make something that both the person and the dog can eat. So if we want to work on, you know, exploring new foods, or I don't do too much feeding, but, you know, sensory related things, having to, you know, touch everything that you're putting into the treat or meal. So there can be very unique ways that you structure the intervention or phrase things to someone that can really get them to do more than they might have done without the dogs. Uh-huh. Like sometimes we can get more repetition out of them or more duration. For instance, oh, we already did it with Dottie. Now it's Tater's turn. He needs to go.
So I love it.
That's the benefit of having more than one dog.
Yeah, right?
So yeah, I mean, that's a little bit of how they might be involved. I guess, so I mentioned their presence, then they could be motivational. The third way is, but they can really be, like I mentioned, that co-facilitator, or that really, you know, involved part of it, where maybe they're helping to train the dogs to do either obedience or tricks, or even just walking with them requires a lot of different, both motor skills and cognitive and processing skills. So having to figure out like, okay, the dog didn't understand what I just did, or I was trying to cue them either with a verbal cue or a physical cue, but they don't know what I was saying or wanted them to do. So then they have to stop and like problem solve. So I like to kind of, you know, I would prefer the client to try and figure out what to get the dog to do something rather than the dog just listening to me, because mm-hmm. that's not, you know, that's not fun. That's not, you don't get as much out of it. And the client picks up on things like, oh, the dog only listens to you. That's not cool. So we train, or I train my dogs, that I've learned that we like when they can listen to the client's cues, anybody's cues, and they're not always staring at me. We like them to be focused on the client. So that's one maybe differentiation of training them very specifically for this therapeutic purpose than a dog that's just trained for obedience, for instance.
And I feel like that's got to be so, well, I'm sure in the beginning it could be frustrating if the client is trying to get them to do something and the dog, like, they're not communicating it right, they're not using the right cues, whatever it is, and the dog's not responding. But then once they get it, that's got to be so empowering for the client to say, I did that. I communicated whatever it was that I wanted to the dog, and the dog did what I wanted. Like, I can only imagine how empowering that is for the client.
It is very empowering. And that's some of sometimes it is a specific goal, but other times it's kind of like a nice, like a side effect, is that people become, you know, they get more self-esteem, confidence, self-efficacy, like, hey, I can, you know, learn new things and maybe also teach other people how to do new things. Especially if we have groups, sometimes we'll have, like, you know, people who already know how to do something with the dogs, so now it's their turn to teach the new people how to either groom them or train them and that sort of thing. So it's really nice to have something concrete that they can see, like, hey, I taught the dog how to do this. That's really, could be really powerful.
Yeah, like I said, I was going through your Instagram, and there were a couple of activities that really stood out to me that I'm like, those are great activities, and I never would have thought, like, just because I don't use animals in therapy, I never would have imagined how you actually could. But like, one of them was, you had a person standing, and then you had them like weave the dog in between their legs, like almost in a figure eight. And when I used to do like a lot of handwriting and that type of stuff, like, we'd always do the figure eights on the board, yeah, and make them big, mm-hmm. make them small. And all of a sudden I'm like, this is brilliant. Like, you're getting that whole body movement. You're getting that crossing the midline, and they have the motivation of making the dog do it. So then they're watching the dog as they do it. And I was just like, I love it. This is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really cool that actually, I didn't even make the connection of the figure eights with handwriting, but now I will in the future.
Right.
that's really great too. You know, everyone has different thoughts when they see things, but that, I guess, doing the figure eights maybe originally came from like dog freestyle. So freestyle dancing with dogs, where people kind of move to music and have dogs weave between their legs or circle around them or walk backwards away from them and come back to them, like all sorts of crazy things. But it's really cool when you get into working with animals, especially dogs, that there's different things that you can draw from, kind of like our own continuing education too, that I've done dog agility classes, freestyle classes, nose work, to really learn more about what are things that people can do with dogs and have fun together, and how might I be able to incorporate that into therapy as well. So Dottie is my agility dog. She, which really helps, you know, if we're doing obstacle courses and that sort of thing, or doing things a lot more physical movement. She's more of the active dog and loves to get people moving and thinking. And versus Tater, he's kind of like easygoing. He's like, oh, I'm happy doing anything, but he's not necessarily like the best at everything, which is okay too. It's really cool to just also see the different activities that the dogs prefer, and that's what we also like to look at, like what does the dog like to do, and that's what we would, you know, have them do more of, because that makes a difference too. Like I mentioned, when they see the dog having fun, that makes it more motivating and encouraging for the client to participate, versus the dog's kind of whatever about it, then of course the client's gonna be whatever too.
Yeah. One of the other activities that I thought was so cool was, I think you called it a magic blanket or magic carpet ride, where the dogs will lay down on a blanket and then the client actually has to pull them. And I was like, oh my goodness, I love it. It's such a cool, very like simple activity, but working on so many different skills.
Yeah, that's another one that I learned at Dogwood. And it's really cool to even just, you know, using everyday items too. You can kind of look around and see what you can come up with. And we also like to, like I mentioned, phrase things in certain ways. So maybe taking the focus off the person sometimes, like, hey, we're going to train the dog to ride on this blanket. I'm not necessarily saying like we're going to work on proprioceptive input and pulling and arm strength. Of course we want them to know that's what they're doing, but sometimes like maybe they don't want to think about it at that moment. So that's really fun, where we give them incentive, like this is how we're going to train the dog to stay on the blanket. So you have to make sure you tell them stay, and if they're staying like every two or three steps, then you give them, you say yes and give them a treat. So those are a lot of steps they have to remember right away, and seeing how they do with that too. So there's ways you can grade it and make it easier and more difficult based on how much you want them to remember or how much you want them to do of the activity.
Yeah. Oh gosh. I loved that one. And then I know that you mentioned like cooking and preparing treats and making toys and all of that. But another thing, and again, this is just me, like not really, I hadn't realized it, but dressing and how you can work on dressing using the dogs as well. And I think I saw a picture of, I think it was Tater with some socks on. And like, how motivating is that? Like, rather than, okay, we're going to put socks on you, like looking at the kid or the client and they're like, I don't want to put my socks on, but oh, it's cold out and Tater needs his socks, so we got to put socks on. And all of a sudden they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. That one's definitely a good, you know, like here the dogs, either we're going to do it with the dog or the dog's going to do it first, then you do it type thing. The only thing about dressing I'll have to make a little side note of is that not every dog likes to be dressed up. So right. You have to find the right dogs. Like Tater could care less usually what you're putting on him, but Daddy can be a little bit pickier. So we respect their input.
Oh, yes. I had dogs growing up and my sister has a couple dogs, and there was always the one that was like, whatever, I'm cool with whatever you want to do. And then the other one that's like, no, don't even come near me with that. But I love what you said earlier about the repetition. And I immediately connected with the dressing, because with us, we have 2 feet, you know, especially when we're talking about socks and shoes. Yeah. But with the dogs, it's like, well, there's 4. So we're going to have to do this 4 times rather than just 2. And again, like there's more repetition, there's more practice, there's more exposure to learn and integrate these skills for the client.
Yeah, and even like other basic self-care skills, like for some reason it's one of the favorites of a lot of the clients is brushing the dog's teeth. I'm not quite sure why, but maybe because it's so strange to them at first. But that's one of like the most requested activities, like, oh, I want to go brush the dog's teeth now. And it's interesting because sometimes it comes from the people who might not brush their own teeth that well. So I find that the most interesting, like, oh. So even when they're, you know, having to open the toothpaste and squeeze the toothpaste onto the toothbrush, that can be difficult on it in itself to know, like, the right amount of toothpaste or where to put it on the brush. So even though we're not necessarily brushing their own teeth at that moment, they're still working on some of their own, you know, self-care skills. And then hopefully later on we can, okay, we're going to brush the dog's teeth first, and now it's your turn. And that might get them more willing to engage in that.
I definitely feel like within like the pediatric realm, teeth brushing tends to be one of those skills that there tends to be a lack of motivation to do across a majority of the clients. And so, yeah, that's actually really interesting that they might not want to do it for themselves, but they want to do it for the dogs, and how to be able to kind of bridge the gap of doing it for the dog and then getting them to be able to do it.
Yeah. So really, like, sometimes we're learning kind of individual skills, and now we have to figure out how we can generalize them to either their own lives or you know, everything else that's going on.
Oh, I love that comment. Individualized to generalizing them. That's perfect. So I'm curious, what do you feel like some of the biggest challenges are to incorporating the dogs within your therapy sessions?
Definitely sometimes, like, managing like where maybe the dogs are and the client figuring out if it's a good match at that moment in time, because maybe one day they do really well with the dogs, but the next day they're kind of, they could be dysregulated or, you know, something else is going on. So really having to assess like every single moment almost if the dog is appropriate in the session, if the client's going to be appropriate. So it is a lot of kind of knowing
it's like mental bandwidth that you have to constantly use.
As well as, like I mentioned, the multitasking part where maybe the dog is playing with something and then you have a client here and then I have another dog over there. I have to know, you know, exactly where everyone is. Are they being safe? Is there anything that could potentially go wrong in this situation? So sometimes, you know, I'll have a dog in another room or in their crate resting and like having them take turns. So knowing your own skill level too, like, can I manage more than one dog at a time, or should I only do one dog at a time, or do I need someone else to help hold the dog? So like either a volunteer or, you know, another therapist, like whatever your setting is. You know, also some people might not, especially starting off, might not have the ability to handle both the dog and be working with the client at the same time. So that's why I mentioned, you know, volunteering with the dog first definitely helps with the dog piece of it. But then once if you start to bring that into work, then that could be a whole nother ball game.
Oh, completely. I mean, that safety aspect and the mindset of the dog and kind of having your eye on everything while also paying attention to everything that you're doing in front of you. I can imagine that is a big challenge and something that takes some time to really kind of get good at and be able to manage and not like drive yourself insane of like, oh, wait, what's going on over there? Oh no, what just happened? You know, something like that.
Yeah. And to be honest, some people figure out that it's not like their thing or something that they can't do. So then they might rely more on like having volunteers come in. So that's another way that some people might be involved in animal assisted therapy. Maybe they don't have their own dog or their dog's not suitable. They might call in a team to kind of assist them in their intervention, but the team still needs to know like what, still needs to get that continuing education about animal assisted interventions and how to work with dogs in that setting. So it's, I think that's the other challenge. Like people don't really realize maybe how much or what kind of education they should be getting or what kind of experiences. I've heard of some people that kind of just like, oh, I thought it'd be cool to just bring my dog into work, which is, you know, it could be, there could be a lot of risks there. Ideally, the dog should be trained, but maybe you haven't assessed them or evaluated them in that environment. It's, you know, kind of unpredictable things that happen in a therapy environment. So there's a lot that could go wrong. There's kids or other individuals that are scared of dogs or allergic to dogs. So there's a lot more to consider than just thinking like, it would be nice to bring my dog into work. So that's a big, I think, issue that we're struggling with as a field or I don't know what you call it, specialty area, I'm not sure.
Yeah, practice area.
Yeah, practice area. And that's kind of what at least Animal Assisted International is trying to, I believe they're very, very close to publishing the competencies for different levels of interventions, kind of like I mentioned, what should you be able to do or know how to do animal assisted activity versus animal assisted therapy. So they're very close to publishing that, and that can help provide a guideline of like, what should I learn, or like, what do I know right now? What do I need to know? They already have standards of practice that are published, but I believe they might be being revised. So I'm not 100% sure what the current edition is on the website, but that kind of also gives people an idea of, like, these are things I need to have in place, from even just simple things like cleaning up after the dog. Are there procedures in place to make sure that, you know, things are disinfected, all of that? Or there are things in place for screening clients? But just in general, there's a lot that goes into it, and instead of just thinking one day that I can just bring my dog into work with me.
Yeah, I want to thank you for making that comment, because even just from our discussion so far, there's so much that goes into this, from the dog itself to the facility that you're using, to the techniques, to the training of the dog, to the environmental aspects of the other people that you're bringing in. And I mean, so much. That's like 1% of everything that you have to kind of consider when you're using this within your practice. And I think it's really good to kind of mention that it's not just, oh, I like dogs, I can bring a dog into the therapy session. Like, yeah, you might luck out and it might go well, but there is so much other things to consider and to get experience, to get exposure, to get educated, to get training, to get all of that, I think is really, really beneficial if somebody is interested in using dogs or using animals within their practice and their therapy sessions.
Yeah. Sorry, just jump in. I just logged onto the Animal Assisted Intervention International website, which is AAI-INT.org. And the standards have been updated. They were revised December 15th, 2018. So the most up-to-date version is there now. So that could be good to look at. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, send me that link and I'll make sure that I put it in the show notes. So if anybody is curious to check out the most recent updates to that.
And like I mentioned, the competencies are very close to being ready to be published, as well as an accreditation process will hopefully be available by the end of this year. And that would be for members. So that's similar to how, you know, like hospitals are accredited. Like there's a lot of different things you have to demonstrate. But that's a really great direction to be going in for this area.
Yeah, completely. And so I want to talk a little bit, because I know that you started your own practice called Sundog Therapy. And so I'd love for you to just share a little bit more about what your practice entails and kind of what it looks like right now.
I decided to start my own business called Sundog Therapy. So Sundog can mean a bunch of different things. One of the original, I guess, words is it's cool. It's a cool effect that happens when the sun is at a certain part of the sky and there's like two, like, I guess, flashes of light that are kind of on the outsides of it, and sometimes it looks almost like a rainbow. But so I really liked that it was, you know, related to nature. Here in California, it's usually sunny all the time.
Not today.
And in Albuquerque in New Mexico is also sunny most of the year. So I and my dogs enjoy being out in the sun. So we really like the kind of having that connection with, you know, brightness, cheerfulness, that sort of thing. So that's kind of, some people ask what Sundog Therapy means. But I really wanted to kind of branch out on my own and be able to really do a lot more animal assisted therapy, because I have worked in a couple other places, and sometimes just, you know, the facility is maybe not the right setting, or like I mentioned, there's some logistical issues. Like maybe if I were to join a pediatric practice. I've spoke with a few people like, oh, would it be possible to start an animal assisted therapy program here if I were to work here? And they're like, oh, that would be really cool, but we have a lot of people that are allergic or scared of dogs, or where's the dog going to go? We don't really have space for if the dog's on a break, like different sorts of little things. And so that really got me thinking that, like, well, why can't I go about this on my own and I don't have to worry about, you know, a boss telling me I can't do this or can't do that. And, right. You know, that sort of, I guess, mentality. I didn't really want to feel as limited. And I was fortunate to be have most of my, I guess, internship or field experiences under someone who kind of worked for themselves, had their own private practice. So that kind of both helped me get experience in that area as well as, you know, inspired me like, okay, this is something that I can do. Of course, it happened slowly. So first I had to decide on the business name.
Oh, gosh. I think that's one of the hardest parts.
Yeah. And even now, like, I'm not even sure if I'm keeping the therapy part of it because I do a bunch of other things, which I'll get into, but so we'll figure it out. But, you know, everything from the legal side, like becoming here in California to become an S Corp or professional corporation to have a therapy business. So I had to go through all that process. And at the time I was kind of in between. I was working here in California, but then I was also thinking of going back to Albuquerque, and I ended up doing that. So I kind of got to ease into it. So I had my own business established, but I was, you know, providing contract work to Dogwood so I could get paid through the business and learn more about accounting and all of that, but not have to worry so much about marketing and getting new clients and billing insurances and that sort of thing. So I was there for, like I mentioned, another year, and now I came back almost a year ago back to California, so in March of last year. And then I really wanted to kind of launch Sundog Therapy here because before I was working in Albuquerque mostly. And so I've had a lot of challenges and learning experiences of marketing now and how to get, you know, my name out there and what kind of programs I want to develop. So right now I offer OT sessions, so individual with children and adults. Of course, I'm selective of who I can provide therapy to since I'm not an expert in different areas. Like I don't do feeding. I don't do certain, you know, types of diagnoses just because I don't have experience in it. So being my own boss, like I have control over what clients I accept, which is, I guess, it's a really important role to have.
Yes.
And I have to be careful with it because, of course, you know, if I could say a yes to everybody, but that might not be doing that person justice if I don't feel I'm the most suited to treat that person and what they're experiencing.
And I think, too, I'm going to jump in here, especially when you are, I mean, you had started the business, but you were really just getting it off the ground in California. Like you had had the work in Albuquerque, but almost kind of starting fresh here,
exactly.
Having to get a new client base. And I think it's very easy when you are just trying to get off the ground to say yes to everything, even if it's not the right fit or the perfect situation for you. And so I'm so glad that you mentioned that because I think a lot of people kind of jump in and they're like, yeah, I'll do that. And all of a sudden it's like, well, I don't really have that experience, or I'm not really passionate about that type of population that I'm working with or something like that. And so I think that's a really good skill that you learned very early on of like, I'm going to do what I know and what I'm comfortable with doing, and I'm going to say no to everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm still learning what I'm comfortable with too at the same time, which can make it a little bit challenging. But I do have a couple other like part-time jobs, and that way I can get more experience in other areas too. So that's, I guess, another thing to mention. You can have your own business and also be doing, you know, other work.
Yes, completely.
Because I still need, you know, I still need to be able to pay rent and feed my dogs and all that sort of thing. Yeah, so I do provide OT services, mostly individual services this time. I hope to do groups because I really like doing groups. But in the meantime, I also offer recreational or like enrichment classes for kids who want to just learn more about working with dogs. Either some of them might have dogs themselves or they might not have dogs. So getting that experience to interact with Dottie and Tater, my dogs, can be really beneficial. They already, you know, are trained, but they can also teach the kids a lot of different things. So sometimes we do like pet care, dog training, what do dogs need to be healthy, doing simple activities with them, like a little bit of the agility and games and all that. So it's just really a fun class for kids to get positive experiences with dogs that I'm offering a few different places now that are hoping that can either expand or become like an ongoing thing. And then since I mentioned earlier that I'm also a dog trainer, so I'm even exploring, you know, things kind of outside of OT, but sometimes they're related. So sometimes I have clients that are therapists that want to learn how to train their dogs and work with their dogs, possibly in their therapeutic setting. So that's been really cool to be involved in that, as well as sometimes my clients might have pets. So, you know, working with, like, how do you train a dog to work with someone with a disability? Maybe they're not becoming a service dog, but, of course, there's different techniques or ways to train a dog that might, or equipment that might be best for one person who maybe has limited mobility or limitations in other ways. So using that OT knowledge is really beneficial there, because a lot of dog training is actually training the human to train their dog.
Yes. The other thing I wanted to point out too, because I was kind of looking at your website and I noticed that you have links to various resources for research and some of the organizations that you had mentioned earlier. So if people are interested, there are those things that are listed on your website as well.
Another thing to mention, or another opportunity for OTs, is people ask me about like assistance dogs a lot of time, or emotional support animals. So those are, you know, two different things as well. I have a little page that kind of describes the differences, but there is an opportunity for OTs to collaborate with assistance dog organizations. I'm a field representative trainer for Paws with a Cause, which is based in Michigan, but they need field reps throughout the U.S. who know about people with disabilities and about dog training. So you have to have both of those, knowledge pieces. But we are the ones that go and do needs assessments, so kind of like an OT evaluation almost. Like, what are the needs of someone for this piece of, it's basically a piece of medical equipment, is an assistance dog. So that's really helped me in that role, looking at someone's strengths and what are their needs. What tasks can the dog do for this person that would help them? And then later on, we do the placement process too. So once the dog is trained by the organization, then we go in and bring the dog to them and teach them how to work with the dog and be a partner with them. But other organizations I know of, sometimes they will need an OT. They might need an OT to evaluate the person to kind of help them figure out if this person's going to be a good fit, what maybe modifications to either equipment or different things in their house might they need for this situation. So there's different ways you can be involved in the assistance dog world too, for people who are interested in that.
So it sounds like you are busy.
Yeah, I am very busy.
And you wear many hats, because, I mean, I feel like so much of what you're talking about ties right into OT, but on the surface, they're very different. But you're always kind of utilizing your therapeutic lens and your OT lens as you go about all these kind of other roles that you have.
Yeah, I like to do lots of different things, as you can tell, but it's true that, you know, the OT lens is the basis for a lot of what I do, even if I'm not specifically providing OT for these different things.
I just have kind of a random question. I'm going to throw it out there to you. And I'm curious, what's one thing that you do every day that you think makes you successful?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like you probably you mentioned before, and that we talked about, there's a lot that I have to do each day or juggle. So it helps to like write down maybe the purpose. There's something that I hope to achieve that day Sometimes I write down a little bit too much, so I'm trying to get better at like writing down like just one or two things. But I think having something written down that you can look back to, because you know you get busy, you might forget, like, oh, what was I supposed to do today? But that really helps, because right now, if I were to write down everything on my to-do list, it'd just be pages and pages, and that gets really overwhelming. So I think it definitely helps to just have like one goal for each day that you want to be able to accomplish.
I love that. I think that's such great advice, because the more and more OTs that I talk to and other professionals, everybody's busy. Everybody has so much on their plate. And I include myself too. And it's very easy for us to get distracted, to have something thrown at us that we have to pay attention to, we have to attend to, we have to complete, we have to get done, whatever it is. And it's very easy to kind of lose sight of what the goal is of what you're trying to accomplish, especially like on a day-to-day basis. And so I love it. Writing it down, having it there, you can look at it, it like stares you in the face. And it's like, oh yeah, that's what I'm doing today. That's what I'm focusing on today. And whatever doesn't have to get done today, I can push that off to a later date.
Yeah, and it can be very simple too, like even just responding to this email. Like, I'm going to respond to this email, because sometimes I do get very overwhelmed, like, oh, I didn't get everything done that I wanted to, and I have to kind of refocus and reframe, like, oh, but I was able to do this. I was able to get this crossed off my list. So it's tricky, but it definitely helps to have things written down and be able to look back on it.
Yeah. And I think too, this goes back to when we were talking about like being empowered. So you write down one thing, and if you accomplish it, you're like, yeah, I did it. I did my goal for today.
Yeah, I really drew a line through it, and that makes me feel good.
Yeah. And one of my friends, he sends out an email every day, and it's a short little email, and he sends it out first thing in the morning. And one of the ones that he had sent out recently was talking about, like, basically talking about the same thing of like writing down one thing that you can accomplish that day. And if you haven't written anything down, and say it's like later on in the day, and you're like, man, I haven't done anything, I haven't accomplished my goal today, he's like, write down something that you already did. And then cross it off, because that almost like that gives you that feeling of like, I did do something. Like, I'm not a complete waste of space today. I got out of bed. I brushed my teeth. I like made breakfast, whatever it was, something that you did, and cross it off. And then you can write something else down and then cross it off. And it just kind of gives you that sense of pushing forward and continuing to make progress, and every day just becoming kind of 1% better.
Yeah, and even just if you just relax that day, that counts too, because you definitely need breaks too.
Exactly.
From everything that's going on.
Right? Mental health and self-care is just as important as crossing things off of like physical things that you have to get done. Good, very good point. I'm glad you threw that in there. And yeah. So this episode, oh, this has been absolutely wonderful. I've learned so much just in chit-chatting with you and hearing more about this practice area of animal-assisted therapy, just the different roles that dogs and animals can play. And thank you so much for coming on the show today. This has been just awesome. Really, really fun. And I wanted to give you the opportunity that if people had questions for you, they wanted to learn more about your company, learn more about this practice area, where can they find you?
So my website is www.sundogtherapy.com. So that's SUNDOG therapy. And I have a lot of information on there, and I did go over a lot today, but of course there's a lot more that could be said. And if anyone has specific questions too about either what they want to do with animals in their settings, or any general questions, I'll be happy to answer them through email. So have a lot more resources I can provide. There's different online continuing education courses related to either human-animal interactions or animal-assisted therapy that kind of get people started, get it some basic knowledge going, and I can direct you to where you can get more hands-on experience or whatever knowledge that you need or want to get. I can assist in that process. I'm also trying to get more onto social media. So I have an Instagram. It's @sundogtherapy. I'm trying to post, I've been posting once a week, so I'm trying to post more often. And that kind of has a combination of both. What are some activities that we do in animal assisted therapy, some equipment that I might use, and also some little dog training tips too that will be on there. It's also on Facebook too, if you're more of a Facebook person.
And your dogs are the cutest thing. So if you want to go get a visual of what Tater and Dottie look like, go check out Instagram or Facebook or the website, because, oh, they're just too cute.
Yeah, I can't stop staring at them sometimes. But so that's, I guess, another thing to know. Don't be distracted by your dogs during therapy. That's sometimes hard to do. But
well, and they've been so good during this interview, too. I'm like, there might have been like one little peep and that was it.
Yeah, they've been sleeping. Just Dottie will come by and check on me every now and then, see if I'm done.
Okay, so I have just one last question for you.
Okay.
And this is something that I ask all my guests right at the end. And so if you could describe occupational therapy in one word, what would it be?
I would probably say meaningful. That is kind of what got me most interested in it at first. Like, that is what we focus on, the meaning of our activities, what is meaningful to each person. So that's always kind of been what I associate a lot with what OT does or what OT means to other people too.
Perfect. It's a great word. I love hearing what everybody has to come up with for this, because again, it's one of those things, there's so much to say about OT and putting it into one word is really, really hard, but meaningful. I think that is just perfect. So thank you so much, Karen, for coming on the show today, sharing about everything that you are up to and everything that is kind of going on within the world of animal assisted therapy and beyond, I should say. And this has been just so fun, and I really appreciated getting the time to chat with you today.
Yes, thank you for having me on your podcast. It's been really fun.
Hey, before you go, I just wanted to say thanks for listening to today's episode. If you want to further the discussion, go to our website, otforlife.com, and join our Facebook group. If you like us, here are three easy ways to let us know. 1, share our podcast with a friend, colleague, or anyone interested in occupational therapy. 2, leave us a review on iTunes or anywhere this podcast is found. 3, subscribe to us so you don't miss out on any upcoming episodes. Thanks again. We'll catch you next time, OT for Lifers.
I had a power outage this morning.
Oh.
Because of the rain.
No. I was like checking the time on the things.
It was probably like 8 o'clock, maybe 7:45 or something. And I looked at my husband. I was like, well, maybe I'm not going to be recording today. We'll see if it kicks back in. So it hasn't gone out since, but just warning you in case it decides to just go kaput on us. Oh my gosh, now I'm like totally losing my words. Woo! And everything just like goes out the window.
Yeah, I'm trying to think because it's there's a lot of different, I don't know, words that you can use.
I'm making you think.
Yeah.
Right? Get yourself comfortable.
Yeah, and get my dogs situated too.
Actually, I think it will be good if the dogs do make some noise in the back. I think it will be really fitting.
Yeah. Well, one of them just wants to play ball right now.
Oh, so. No.
So Dottie just came up.
Yeah. She's like, you're moving.
Well, she knows when I'm ending a call. It's really strange. Like, oh, she knows so based on the tone of my voice or what I'm saying. Even because I didn't even say bye yet. Sometimes I thought it was because I said bye, but no.
Nope.
She can tell. It's very, very interesting.
She's ready.